On the 7th of November 1918, 4 days before the armistice, the New York Times reported the taking of Lecanwar in northern France by the New Zealand Division, and the headline they used was "Great Exploits by Haig's Men. Their winning of Lecanwar was a triumph of valour and tactics. The New Zealands did it." But the question I want to ask you this week in the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, call Tales from the Battlefields was, why would the New York Times be so interested in the capture of a small town by New Zealand troops during that last week of the war? Well, during the next hour or so in this podcast, we're going to find out why it was of so much importance and so well reported, so widely reported around the world. And we're going to do that with an interview with the New Zealand historian Christopher Pugsley. A few weeks ago, I was in Lecanwar with a New Zealand family who we featured in podcast a couple of weeks ago. And whilst I was just about to leave the museum that's there, I noticed this book called Lecanwar, New Zealand's Last Battle, 1918, and it had been written by Christopher. So I couldn't find him on social media, but I did manage to find him on email, and he kindly agreed to come on the podcast and talk about what happened in that small town all those years ago. But before we start, let's just have a look at a couple of the newspaper reports that described the tremendous success of those Kiwis. The Grey River Argos reported the battle under the headline, "New Zealanders' Great Exploits. Yesterday's victory was a most sweeping one. The German defeat could not be more complete. The capture of Lecanwar will be remembered as one of those thrilling episodes in this campaign." On Armistice Day, New Zealand's Minister of Defence, Colonel Sir James Allen, sent a message to his troops that were still in northern France. And he said, from the landing at Anzac on the 25th of April 1915 to the surrender of Turkey and to the storming of Lecanwar on the 4th of November 1918, you have fought and conquered in battle whose names shall be familiar in our mouths as household words. You have won for New Zealand a fame imperishable. God bless you and bring you safely home to us. In a British newspaper, The Times, they gave even more credit to the New Zealanders when they reported what had happened in what was to become known as the Battle of the Sambre. Quoting from The Times, it says, "The outstanding incidents of the attack were the crossing of the canal, the capture of Catalan by the 1st Division, and the surrounding and final reduction of Lecanwar by New Zealanders, and the rapid advance by the 25th Division. Undoubtedly, however, the most dramatic episode was the capture of Lecanwar. It's an old fortified town with huge earth ramparts which have stood many sieges. It was held in great strength, and New Zealanders were compelled to draw back from their first attempt to storm it frontally, though they succeeded in carrying the outer circuit of the ramparts. Then they proceeded to encircle the town. They worked round both north and south in the face of determined resistance until the two parties met on the opposite side. Leaving Lecanwar thus beleaguered, the main body of New Zealanders went on and got amongst the German guns, and the division alone took about 100 prisoners, with the wagons and personnel of all batteries practically complete. Going on, the New Zealanders carried all before them, having the stubborn opposition to overcome at many points. All this time, Lecanwar, within its ancient fortifications, was still German. We dropped invitations to surrender from aeroplanes, but with no response, and demands for surrender under the white flag were also refused. In the afternoon, therefore, the attack was resumed, and the New Zealanders fought their way into the streets, when the German commanding officer made formal surrender himself and a garrison of 1,000 men. It was like a passage from some old war, suddenly interpolated into a modern battle." So I think what we'll do is now, we'll play the interview with Chris that I recorded last week. And then when we've listened to that, I'll read a couple of the soldiers' accounts. As usual, we like to look at the battle through the eyes of the soldiers. And by the time we finish the podcast, hopefully, like me, you'll understand a lot more about what happened in this small French town on the 4th of November, 1918.
Yeah, I did. I was New Zealand Army. Joined as a 18-year-old and went to the Royal Military College, Duntroon in Australia,
yeah,
in 1966.
Oh, blimey.
Graduated as a lieutenant in 69 and then served for 22 years and left in 88 as a lieutenant colonel, and really I'd written my first book in 84. I researched Gallipoli, and it led me to being seconded to television for 12 months in 83 while they made a feature-length documentary, because I was the only guy that had been there
Yeah,
and
in those
sort of
days,
walked the
yeah.
ground. And my book, Gallipoli, the New Zealand Story, came out in 84. Suddenly I found the thing I wanted to do if and when I ever left the army.
Yeah, well, you've certainly achieved
And
that, haven't you? Two different careers.
now it's 24 books later, see, so.
24. And the podcast that I did last week, just about the Somme, tremendous interest in what the New Zealanders did during the Great War. Because it, to me, it, coming from Britain, it seems so incredible that people should come from the other side of the world to fight in a conflict which doesn't directly affect them. They're fighting for the Commonwealth, aren't they?
Well, but it's in the context of the times, our biggest support. We saw ourselves as a little Britain, really, and really the First World War forced us to address national interests because we suddenly realized that British decision often didn't take small dominions into account. We had a population of 1 million at the time. We sent 100,000 soldiers to war as part of the 9% of the total population went to war, 60,000 casualties,
It's a big percentage.
18,000 dead. And really, other than Britain, which had a higher percentage, we were the largest percentage of any of the dominions at the time.
And such a small country, it's a tremendous sacrifice and a commitment, isn't it, from the whole nation, really.
And really, I don't think any country anticipated what that war was going to be like.
No, or any participant. And so, have you got personally any family then that fought in the Great War?
My background, I was born in Wales. And my parents came out to New Zealand when I was 5 in 1952. And my father's family came from Barnstaple, in Devon. And my grandfather served in the garrison artillery with the heavy batteries, he had, or I think he had three children at that stage. So he was enlist he was conscripted about in 17. He served over in France in 1718.
And did you know your grandfather then?
No,
No.
he died the year I was born. My mother was always pro forces.
Yeah.
And so,
It's in your blood, isn't it? Military's in your blood.
yeah, well, and also growing up in, I was at Christchurch in the South Island school. I wanted to see the world, and if I hadn't found that I loved researching and writing and walking the battlefields, which is, was something I'd always used. I was involved in officer training. I set up the New Zealand commissioning course in the 70s, and I was at tactical school and brigade major of our operational brigade. And while you could look at a theoretical exercise on a piece of ground that you'd picked, if there was a battlefield where something really happened, In the context of the times with muskets and muzzle loading cannon, what happened then? And then say, well, if this was a defended village in Southeast Asia, and we had an infantry battalion, and this is going back to 60s and 70s, what would be different? How, what appreciation would the officers make? And so It was a teaching tool, and one that I'd used all my career. And I applied that to Gallipoli. When I went to Gallipoli, I said,
You're looking at it through different eyes, aren't you? You're looking at it through military.
"Yes." And when I went to Gallipoli, I got the maps from the Staff College, and I knew bugger all about the campaign, really, because it was, I remember talking about Gallipoli to the Turkish, Ergun Saygun, the Turkish officer, and we argued from a position of sublime ignorance on both our parts, really. But when I walked there, I spent a week there and got adopted by the village and made friends that are still friends,
Oh, brilliant.
and
It's very special, isn't it?
it is, and it's such an emotional landscape anyway.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
I realized I was looking at I was reading that described a rugby match, but in fact I was looking at a tennis court, and you can't play rugby on a tennis court,
Not
so
really,
something
no.
else happened there that I didn't know about. And so I started researching, and I'm still doing it,
That's the start of a long journey that will never end, isn't it, really? It'll never ever end for any
And
of us, will it?
well, I enjoyed my first career, and it led naturally into my second career, which was also my hobby. So,
I know what you mean.
and so I've been very lucky, and
Fortunate, not luck, because you make your own luck, but good fortune.
And Sandhurst, they paid me to indulge.
That's fantastic.
Because there were 16 military historians in our department, and we divvied up the world. And I said, "I'm interested in Northwest Europe and the Mediterranean, because that's where the New Zealanders served." And not that I'll look at New Zealanders specifically, but because in looking at the bigger picture, I'll have an opportunity to also walk the ground where the New Zealanders.
And yeah, as you say,
And
you have to.
I remember going, the first big battlefield tour I did was Mons Lakato. And of course, coming back from Mons Lakato is the same ground where the New Zealanders took going forward in
Going forward, yeah, 4
1918.
years later.
And Lassini Farm and all of that, you're just looking at a different story, but the
Yeah,
same
well,
ground.
playing ground,
And
going a different direction. The battle plan itself, how did the New Zealanders find themselves? I know they'd been through and taken back home, hadn't they, in the previous week. So what was the plan for this particular location?
Third Army gets involved, and Harper's Fourth Corps, which the New Zealand Division is a part, starts its 1918 advance on the 26th of August. And over that period, up until end of October, New Zealand is very much part of Harper's Corps spearhead. And you've got the hard fighting around Bapaume, and then after that, of course, you've got Havrincourt, and pushing on up into Salem. Basically, the British armies are on a logistic shoestring by the end of October, and there's a pause to gather breath. Then you've got the final battle, which is, and it's all for communications, and you're looking at the Battle of the Sambre and going for critical communication junctions. And as part of Byng's Third Army, Harper's Fourth Corps is aiming for Maubeuge, which is on the Sambre River. And of course, two divisions up, with Sixth Corps on your left, and the New Zealand Division facing a cork in the bottle at Lakenwa. Then another major obstacle with the Maumal Forest, and then the River Sambre
on the eastern edge of the Mormal Forest. And
Yep.
so
The plan for the 4th of November attack is to gain crossings over the Sombra River. By the 5th of November, they want to have crossings over the Sombra River by last light on the 5th. What makes the October, end of October, November battles different for
Almost all the British armies is the fact, for the first time, the Germans haven't been able to clear out the local populations. You know, up until then, Bapaume, all of that population has largely been evacuated. But now, of course, your villages have still got their local populations, and Lekenwa is, I think, normally had about 5,000, 6,000 people, and it was down to about 2,000. But it still had a civilian population there, as did the surrounding villages.
They wouldn't
And
have had time
so,
to clear out the
no, that's
Brilliant
right,
Popular because they're
because the
retreating at
advance
such
had been
pace. Yeah.
too quick.
Yeah.
And so Byng, some people say, you know, some of the myths say that it was Russell that determined that there shouldn't be any civilian casualties. No, the army commander directed his corps commanders to avoid civilian casualties at all costs. And Russell, who is an outstanding divisional commander, and that shows in both his training and his command. Haig, he is the only Dominion commander, divisional commander, who's offered command of a British corps. You know, because
Yeah,
when you look
so
at
good.
Currie and Monash, they're commanding their national corps. Haig sees Russell, believes Russell has the same capacity, and offers him a British corps. However, Russell realizes at this stage the new 1918 manpower crisis, reduction of British divisions down to three battalions per brigade, three platoons within each of the companies. By contrast, New Zealand has guaranteed 2,000 trained reinforcements a month. And after the Kaiser Offensive in March 1918, accelerates its reinforcement program. So Russell is in the situation where he has, in November, he has a reinforcement pool in the UK or in the divisional depots in France of 10,000 reinforcements. Now, the Canadian Corps, the Australian Corps have scraped the barrel, bottom of the barrel. They have hardly any reinforcements left. And you've got this one division that is at 18,000 strong and can, after each pause in the battle, can call up.
Fresh reserves.
And
In 1917, it has four brigades. That brigade, the fourth brigade, is
disbanded in Christmas 1718, but its officers and reinforcement officers and NCOs and its soldiers end up becoming the first reserve. And so you're not only getting reinforcements, but you're getting people that have fought through 17 and know the business.
And Harper recognizes that, unlike the British divisions that are now down to 10,
approximately 10,000 strong, he's got an 18,000 strong division on the old scale, four platoons each company,
four battalions in each of his three brigades,
so they're
you
almost
know,
at full strength then, aren't they? If not at full strength.
and so they've, you know, they've got twice the infantry power of a typical British division at this stage.
And that's why Lekenwa, you know, the Ger and of course the Germans now, a German division is about 2,000. They've been bled white, and also the critical need is the New Zealand division at full strength has 5,500 horses, which is for an infantry division, when you think dragging your artillery, your transport and everything else. And people forget that the horse is critical. And for the Germans, they're now reduced to a one horse team of four horses for every three artillery pieces.
Mm.
And so they're forced by necessity, as they do at Lakenwa, to group all their artillery as close as possible to the eastern edge of the fortified town because they need them in bulk, because the exhausted horses are going to have to go backwards and forwards three times to the next delay position. And by that stage, they realize that it's becoming a do or die situation, but you still want to get your guns out before you pull back your infantry. And so Russell's plan
is the major defensive position is to the west on the railway line, the German defensive position. You've got the railway where it runs at present through to Maubeuge to the north, and you've got that open ground, all apple orchards to the south.
Okay.
And you've got this cork in the bottle, Vauban's fortified town, which is a major obstacle simply because it's there. And Russell's plan is to break through the railway line, encircle the town using his weakest brigade, which is the rifle brigade, and that's why they get the job.
Okay.
Having encircled the town, push the North Island Brigade, which is made up of the two battalions of Wellington, two battalions of Auckland. First Auckland are given to the Rifle Brigade because they need that other battalion to finish off the encirclement to the north. Those three battalions of 1st Brigade encircle, pass around the town, which is encircled by the Rifle Brigade, in part because it's on the border with the division to the north and the division to the south, push through along that border, divisional borders, and advance initially to the Green Line, and then which is around Portel, the Chateau de Portel, that lovely little chateau there, and then push on to the edge of the Mormal Forest. During that rapid encirclement and push through, they capture the German divisional artillery. They simply have no time to get out.
Ignore it. Yep.
And originally, the whole strength of the German line is on that eastern railway line, which is now that they've dug it up, and it's now the highway that you drive up to on the eastern, on the western side, sorry.
And of course, the Rifle Brigade, with hard fighting, break through that railway line and initially push a battalion to the north and a battalion to the south and complete the encirclement. The remainder follow through, and immediately after that, the artillery starts to leapfrog forward. And supporting this, there are 12 brigades of artillery, you know, and plus special engineers who are firing what we would term a first generation form of napalm and smoke onto
these are new developments,
the
aren't they?
And that really is to shield the move forward, both of the infantry and the artillery, because the artillery has to keep up. And of course, the fire plan, it's a complex, a marvelously complex battle. And of course, today, it's the four guys climbing up over the wall that gets attention. But what you've got
is this superbly orchestrated divisional attack whereby Russell always believed right in the through the advance that villages and towns are obstacles to be bypassed. And this fits in with what he has been doing with his division in September, October. And so now he's got another bypass plan, pushing the a brigade through to keep the advance, capture the German guns, and push up to the edge of the Mormal Forest. That's the first major objective.
First objective, yeah. Okay.
And then, and he does that. And of course, what happens to the German garrison that's on the railway line? Now, they're supposed to pull back to an intermediate objective. They suddenly find that they can't pull back because they've been outflanked on either side.
They've got nowhere to go.
So, and they go into the city, into Le Quesnoy itself.
Oh, right.
Other than the hospital, which has had about 300 or 400 German wounded, there's the garrison of Le Quesnoy is initially about 200 because the major strength is along the railway line.
Yeah.
And then from about 8 o'clock in the morning onwards, the garrison, they've got nowhere else to go. And so instead of heading back to the next line of defense, which doesn't exist anyway,
they've gone inside the town.
The town. Yep. And so suddenly that garrison is close to potentially 800 or 900. And so it makes a lot of difference.
Yes, we've got 1,000 German defenders in the town. How did they have time to defend, set up any defences? Or I suppose they've got the ramparts as their defences, haven't they?
Well, yeah, it's what's happened is that the rifle brigade attack has taken the railway line and now edging forward to the outer network of moats and field works and trying to wedge up to the main fortification wall, which is the one they'll eventually scale near the water gate. The heavy fighting occurs up in what the area to the north, where you've got the Valenciennes gate. That's where today's railway line passes just north of that. Now, that area sees 2nd Battalion, Jardine's 2nd Rifle Battalion, involved in very heavy fighting, and they attempt to push over the causeway leading to the Valenciennes Gate. The Germans blow up the part just before the gate proper, which is the wooden bridge that's the substitute for the old drawbridge. However, there's enough planks for a small party from Charlie Company to try and get across, and with their Lewis gunners behind them trying to keep the fire, suppress any fire from the top of the walls. And it's there that you have the first attempt to get into the town, and you've got a pioneer, Tapsell or Tapihana, who has linked up with this platoon instead of being part of the working party of pioneers that are trying to keep the roads open for the artillery. He swanned off and linked up, and he's the one that attempts. It's difficult to visualize today because they've enlarged the gateway to take in motor vehicles.
Yeah.
But there were two. When you look at the paintings and the photos of the time, there were two side arches for pedestrians with the center access way for the vehicles. And the Germans had simply filled that with timber balks to block, and the top of the arch was a gap. Had it been manned, you could fire through from the other side.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
This is that state of flux where the Germans are still reorganizing themselves and gripping up people and sending them hither and yon to protect the walls. And it's during that time that Tapahana tries to get in. And I think he doesn't get, he might, you know, we really don't know exactly how far he got, but he got to a point where he could see through the gap into the town itself, and then comes under fire and pulls back to the small group, section size group, I imagine, that is with him. And then they have no option, because of fire starting to come from the walls itself, to pull back, with the company. Now, if you can imagine in the north with that rifle brigade, along the flank, the western flank, where Barraclough's 4th Battalion are trying to get in, there are parties of Germans holding out, and people, small groups of New Zealanders in this maze, defensive maze, which is some places overgrown, some where the lakes are still there, trying to find a route forward to the walls. And all the time, of course, at this stage, there is fire landing on the walls, the main walls, but trying, other than knocking down the town hall tower, no fire in the town itself, you know, to avoid the civilian casualties. Evans' platoon is the one that gets to, you know, there's when you walk through towards the Watergate to where they actually put the ladder up against the wall. Just before you get there, you go through that little tunnel.
Yes.
And then Evans' platoon gets as far as that tunnel, and then comes under intense fire, because when you look at the angles, how it's covered, he's been fired from the left and the right and from the center. The survivors, he's killed. The surviving elements of that platoon are then trapped under fire in that embankment through which the tunnel passes for the rest of the day until Barraclough closes up on them 3 or 4 o'clock. They can be seen, but they can't do anything about it because of the intense fire that's coming from the German defenders. And of course, that's building up as they're being reinforced.
So presumably now, the Germans are using machine guns and rifles to fight.
Yes, and they've got
infantry support, direct fire artillery.
Oh, they've got artillery as well.
So there's no way in.
Yeah.
And if you're caught in the open and you're forced into cover, then until they stop firing, you can't do anything about it.
Well, there's no way into the town. There's no way out either, is there? They're trapped.
No, exactly. Exactly. But if you can imagine Port de Valencien, Barraclough trying to get in, and he hasn't got a gateway to go through here. If he gets in, he has to go over the walls. Now, they've already anticipated this. It's an apple-growing area.
Yeah.
They've gone around all the barns and collected all the ladders. And
the extension ladders, you know, that you pull on the rope and you... So they're dual... extension ladders.
Yeah.
And as the Cambridge fire chief at a conference in 2008 at Le Quesnoy demonstrated, he said, if you put a fully kitted soldier and a rifle on one of these ladders and then try to put a second one on,
the
rope would break.
Yeah.
And so if you're going up it, it's one man at a time. And there is only one place in the wall where that ladder will actually reach the top, and that's at the Watergate. But they didn't know it at that point until Evans's party found it. And of course, why is the Watergate there?
because the Bishop of Lekenwa at some point loved ducks, and he built a pond by putting that weir in that you walk over so that the water could be built up for his duck pond.
Well, aren't we pleased that he did do that? Although,
yeah, well, that's right. We wouldn't have this story.
No, that's right. I'll tell you what it sounds like as well. You know, we tell all these stories of trench warfare and stalemates and sieges in World War One. This sounds like a team of commandos from the Second World War, doesn't it, rather than the First World War?
You're looking at a team of commandos that that number five battalions.
Yeah.
And each, well, in fact, we know that Jardine, Barraclough, Cocroft, all the commanding officers of Hart's brigade had bets before the attack.
Really?
As to who would be first.
Who was going to get in there first? Oh, brilliant.
You know, and,
that's great. I love that.
but Hart, the CO, brilliant brigade commander, first New Zealander as a territorial officer to be given one of the New Zealand brigades in France and commands it on the Somme, commands it first at Messines, has warned his COs, we're encircling and we're holding. I don't want needless casualties.
No, no, for the sake of the bet.
and so the COs, when they realise that three battalion can't get in from the south, second battalion can't get in from the north, and Barraclough is stuck with one of his platoons tied down, then they hold tight because the main battle is now being fought by the 1st Brigade advancing, taking the artillery, and fighting their way towards the Mormal Forest. Suddenly, the German support fire stops.
Yeah.
Because they don't know why, but they guess it's either their artillery has moved back or something's happened.
Yeah.
And of course, the firing to the east is diminishing as the New Zealanders advance.
They're taking them.
Throughout the day, it's becoming obvious that A, they can't get out.
Yeah.
And it's obvious the battle is moving eastward.
Yeah.
And so the cavalry are not going to come and save them.
And save the Germans, yeah. So they must have, not only did the New Zealanders realise this was happening, the German infantry, defenders, they know what's going on as well. They know that they're being left behind.
And they know that the plan is working because the brigade reaches the road to the west of the Mormal Forest, and this is by late afternoon.
Yeah.
And of course, at that point, already they've sent prisoners back into the town, suggesting to the commanders it's time to surrender, and that's been rejected. They fly an aircraft over the town, dropping messages to advise them that, you know, it's all
surrounded.
A busted flush. By now, both Jardine to the north, Cocroft to the south, and Barraclough have edged their people forward, taking up, you know, as you walk, there's a series of outer ramparts,
yes,
all of which have now been occupied by New Zealand machine gunners and Lewis gunners.
Yep.
They're bringing up, they're using 18 pounders, and you can still see the shot marks, the explosions on the face of the wall, just on those, as you look to the left of where they go over, you can see.
I've got some photos of that. So if they've got 18-pounder guns firing at that range, that's almost point-blank range, isn't it, against those
exactly.
walls, the defenders?
Because, and what Barraclough, what each of the commanding officers want to do is to suppress the fire from the rampart, from the tops of the rampart.
Before they go up on the ladders. Yeah.
Yeah.
even though they've gathered up the ladders, by the time that they use them on those intermediate positions to get machine gunners up, they've got one ladder left. Barraclough has his reserve company, D Company. That is the one where Avril and Harry Kerr, who is the platoon commander, have recce'd it
and observed it, looking where Evans' party is trapped, and then looking beyond it, realize that the ladder has to be mounted on that weir.
Everything is then put into suppressing any potential fire from the top of the rampart. At about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, that party that you see in the painting that's in the book, one man at a time. You know, you look at some of those other paintings where you show, like in the church in Cambridge, where there's about a million ladders and a million people on them, and that Mantegna, Fortunio Mantegna's illustrated drawing that I also have in the book.
Yeah, there's three soldiers on the ladder in that painting. I'm looking at it now. There's three soldiers and two at the top, and a load more waiting to come up as well at the bottom. That's a myth, then, isn't it?
Avril, Leslie Avril, climbs the ladder, gets to the top with his pistol. He's the Barraclough's intelligence officer. Harry Kerr follows him up. While Avril is at the top and before Kerr arrives, a German head pokes up further along the rampart. Avril fires at him. The head disappears and races into town yelling that the Tommies are over the wall.
On his own.
And everyone surrenders.
Really? At that point?
Yes.
That's fantastic, isn't it? What a result.
Well, they surrender as soon as it's obvious, you know. So
yeah, it's not
by the time fleeing Germans reach certain parts of the town, that's when the surrenders progressively take place. And that becomes obvious to Jardine's 2nd Battalion at the Port de Valenciennes. And they come pushing through, clear the way, and then racing towards the town square, and are held up by the French townsfolk coming out of their cellars and plying them with kisses and brandy. and afterwards, Barraclough elbows his way in after the first four or five guys have reached the top, and he comes up with his signaler and the field telephone to let Hart's brigade headquarters know that he's the first one into the town. And while there's scattered shots and all of that, the Germans recognize that it's all gone. Yeah. There is no savage fighting or hardly any fighting at all in the town itself.
And civilian casualties, absolutely nil.
They knocked down the steeple of the town hall.
That's an observation post.
There's no report of any civilian casualties from that.
They were hungry, weren't they, these civilians?
And this is the first time New Zealanders see the war for what it's intended to be, to drive the Germans from France and free the civilian population.
Yeah. It's the first time they've seen civilians, I suppose, isn't it?
Yes. As the New Zealanders are advancing towards the Mormal Forest, they're experiencing the same thing in the villages they're passing through. And then, of course, that evening, 2nd Brigade push in, replace the 1st Brigade in the Mormal Forest, and continue pushing through the next day, so that by mid to late afternoon, they reach the Sambre River.
Yeah.
And they're having a field day, because all along the Sambre are parties of Germans trying to get back across.
Yeah.
And come under machine and Lewis gunfire.
Well, they're sitting ducks, aren't they? Literally, these German defenders then. They got nowhere to hide.
The hard work continues because the pioneers, Maori pioneers, and the engineers are busy clearing the routes through the forest, and all the small bridges have been blown or destroyed, rebuilding them to get the artillery through because the artillery support. And in fact, the last people that get involved on the 5th, the New Zealand Division have established themselves along the line of the Sambre. They're the only division initially that gets there because the division to the north in 6th Brigade and the division to the south are 1 to 2 kilometres behind the New Zealand progress. Because of that, the Tommies eventually replace the New Zealanders or relieve the New Zealanders on the night of the 5th. The New Zealand artillery stay forward because there is no British artillery forward at that point. And in fact, the New Zealand Artillery Brigade stays forward right up to the armistice, and they fire their last shells on the 9th of November. And by this stage, they're at Hartland, just southwest of Maubeuge. On the 11th itself, the New Zealand Tunnelling Company that have been re-rolled as bridge builders, and they are the ones that make the Havrincourt Bridge, that the longest bridge built by the BEF on the Western Front. They are working in Maubeuge. There's a complex of three bridges which the Germans had destroyed, and that's their role, and the Maori pioneers are working there with them. The infantry pull out and pull back both to Salem and to Lekenwa on the 5th, 6th. The artillery, engineers, and everyone else, transport, stay forward because... Yeah. They're, you know, the logistics.
They're the supply line, aren't they? Because the British, you said,
yeah, and the logistic rubber band is about as stretched as it can go. And now the German division that was defending Lekenwa no longer exists.
Yeah,
it's the bulk of its surviving infantry are surrender with the city.
So do we know in the fight for the town and the surrounding areas what the casualties were for the New Zealanders and the Germans?
Not sure about the Germans because the German division was about 2,000 strong.
Yeah.
Its fighting strength, approximately 800 are taken prisoner.
Right.
And they don't do a body count of the guys that are buried German reports say that division no longer is a functioning division.
And New Zealanders,
and certainly they've lost all their divisional artillery.
And
it's on the night of the night of the 5th that or the night sorry 4th 5th that Ruprecht orders the withdrawal back. And of course, by that stage, it's too late.
They can't withdraw, can they? It's too late, as you say.
Right.
So what about the New Zealand casualties then?
Well, the known battle casualties, as I've got in the book, names keep dribbling in. 196 dead or died of wounds in the battle.
Yep.
You know, compared to, as we saw, Fleur, on the Somme or Messines, you know, strongest division, cock a hoop, expect to be given a break and then go forward again when called for. And of course, on the 11th, they're suddenly told that they won't be doing any more fighting.
Because I suppose what we don't realise is, when we look back at it now, and certainly I don't, is that when they're fighting on the 4th of November, they don't know this is the last major day of the First World War,
and that's the one thing I spoke to Weta about with that figure. It, you know, when you read the text,
it suggests that he knew the war was over.
Yeah.
But he didn't.
No.
We knew the war had a week to go. But the last guys, the last New Zealanders are killed in action, are three gunners forward with one of the artillery batteries on the 7th of November.
Do they get a direct hit from a German gun?
Yeah. And the driver and two of the gunners are killed.
Yeah.
And that's, but obviously some of the wounded at Le Quesnoy on the 4th and on the 5th die later on.
Yeah.
In fact, the last man buried at Brockenhurst before the hospital closes in 1919 is a wounded man who was mortally wounded at Le Quesnoy.
And Brockenhurst was a New Zealand hospital, was it?
Yes, a New Zealand hospital in the New Forest.
Ah, it's in Hampshire, yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And
if you go to the churchyard there, you'll see his grave.
He's buried there. That's somewhere I'm going to have to go. I'm going to have to go and see him. You know, and I'm going to go through and read your book again. And people that want to find your book,
if they go online, the publisher is Oratia Press.
Yeah.
If they email Oratia Press, they'll be told who stocks it.
Yeah.
And where they can get it, say, in the UK.
And I got it simply for people that are listening. I got it off of Amazon. It took about a week to come. It came from Amazon. And you know, not only is there lots more detailed in addition to what we talked about today, but some of the photographs and certainly the painting by George Edmund Butler in there showing what actually happened when they scaled the walls is something
and
so much
and
detail.
Butler was there.
He was there. So this is a photographic memory.
He stood with Avril. Avril described it. Butler was doing sketches.
Oh, really? As it's happening.
He was the official artist on the spot.
Wow.
Everyone says, yeah, well, why didn't Butler juice it up a bit?
Because no, we don't want that.
Boring.
We want real history. So what I'll do is I'll put a link to the book on my on the podcast page of my website, and I'll also put image, Butler's image as well. I'll put that on there as well so people can see that. And hopefully what this will do will stimulate people's interest. It's only to get there, it's only an hour's drive, hour and a quarter from the Somme battlefield, or 45 minutes down from Lille. And it's a place that I don't think a lot of British people are fully familiar with. So hopefully listening to this podcast on a day when they're on the Somme with not a lot to do, this is what they'll do. They'll go out and see what we saw.
Well, Terry, that's great. And, you know, when you go into the city itself and the square there with the car parking and when you walk down towards the gate that leads to the New Zealand Memorial, you go through that what's left of the original castle.
Yes,
and
yes.
You go through the castle gate.
Yes.
One of the first uses of gunpowder by an English army was at Le Quesnoy back in the 14th, 15th century.
Okay, so we really
and
are
so
through history.
History just keeps
all around.
It was a communication bottleneck then. It still is.
Yeah.
And in 1940, during the battle for the fall of France, a Moroccan territorial company, which were, I think, mainly expats that had been mobilized, found themselves in Le Quesnoy and held up, I forget which panzer division it was, for 48 hours.
Wow. So
one company.
History repeating itself, but the other way around.
Yeah, exactly. And in the end, that divisional commander was sacked because his was the one division that didn't keep up.
Yeah.
What we're looking at is just one of the stories.
There's so many.
And then, and Marlborough's campaign, the Battle of Malplaquet, the French army retreated to Le Quesnoy and occupied Le Quesnoy after that battle.
There's so many different podcasts here we'll have to do. And I'll tell you what, the final thought is when we went there with my New Zealander guests last week before, is how welcome. As soon as the French people heard there were New Zealand accents, suddenly they found a table in a restaurant for us that was fully booked. There was no way they were letting us leave. And everybody was so friendly towards us. It was an incredible reaction.
I took the All Blacks there in 2000. The townsfolk just swamped us and
Really?
were so keen to meet the All Blacks that they crowded into the town hall where we were all gathered for the we were all together, and it was so crowded the All Blacks actually couldn't get in.
Had to wait outside.
Well, they were quite happy talking to the girls outside.
Yeah, I bet they were. Yeah. Oh, what a wonderful way to end on. It's an incredible story, isn't it? There's so much more we can do as well. So we'll keep in touch because I've got a lot of reading to do now. And if
Yeah.
it's okay with you, we'll do some more of these in the future.
Oh, yeah. Well, all the New Zealand battlefields I've walked.
Yeah. And when you come over, hopefully you'll come over soon, then we must get together at that stage.
Okay. Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm one of the vice presidents of the Western Front Association,
Ah,
so
right. Yeah.
I've got a that always draws me back. See,
Yes.
so
Yeah. Yeah. You have to come back soon.
yeah.
It
Hey, Terry, it's been a pleasure.
has, hasn't it? Look, we've just run out of time again. We've only got a minute left. So
Okay.
obviously,
Hey.
we've done so much in the last hour and a half, but obviously, I really wanted to thank you so much for doing this and really do appreciate it. And as I say, we've got a lot more to do in the future. So we'll stay in touch, won't
Well,
we?
let's keep in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. You
Hey.
better go to bed, and it's late at night in New Zealand.
Well, it's 10:25.
Yeah. Go and have a hot chocolate.
And the dog is looking up at me and saying, what's going on?
What's going on? It's time for bed. Thank you very
Hey,
much, Chris.
pleasure, Terry.
Take care.
See ya.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
So if you do make the journey to Lekemwa now, the first place you'll go to is the museum itself. And you'll be given a warm welcome, and there's some magnificent displays there. Probably the most impressive feature is what they call the giant soldier, which was created by the people behind Lord of the Rings. And I was going to try and describe what this soldier looks like, but you've really got to go and see it for yourself. It's got so much detail in it, you can look into this soldier's eyes and wonder what he's seen during the last week or so. He's supposed to be a soldier within the 4th Rifle Brigade that took the town, that climbed the ladders. And you can also see the sweat on his cheeks, and he's holding a flower that's been given to him by one of the residents as they made their way into the fortified town in 1918. And then, within about 10-minute walk, probably from the centre of the town, you find yourself at the ramparts where the ladder was famously used that we've been talking about today. And just a few yards from there is the official New Zealand memorial that's actually been carved into the wall itself, into the ramparts itself. The architect for all of the New Zealand memorials abroad was a man called Samuel Hurst Seeger, who came from Christchurch. He spent much of the time between 1920 and 1925 visiting the battlefields, and he wrote to his government talking about his plans for the memorial at Lekemwa. He said, "At Lekemwa, it is proposed to utilise part of the wall on which should be placed a memorial in marble depicting the scale of the walls by New Zealand troops, and to make an appropriate approach and platform." And the memorial was unveiled on the 15th of July 1923. One of the dignitaries that was there was Sir James Allan, who was the New Zealand High Commissioner to London, and he made a speech that said, "The New Zealanders, in scaling the high ramparts of the fortress, which were considered unscalable, reached the final turning point in the war and achieved the pinnacle of their wonderful record. It was a most daring act for a mere handful of New Zealanders to place a flimsy ladder against the great wall and to mount in single file, and its success had a great moral effect on the Germans." In November 2018, on the centenary of the famous battle, they held a national commemorative service in front of the ramparts that were scaled by the New Zealanders.
They shall grow not old, as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them. We will remember them.
Within the museum itself are a number of quotes from soldiers and civilians that were there on that day. An officer that was mentioned by Chris in the interview was Second Lieutenant Leslie Averill, the man that scaled the ladder to start with. And he said the delight of the people of Lekemwai was on being freed again and knew no bounds, that their liberators had come from the other side of the world to help them in their hour of need impressed them very greatly, and this battle was a sacrifice that will never be forgotten. A school teacher in the town said, at last, at 4:30 p.m, the New Zealanders entered through the potern. What a relief, what emotion. To be free, I walk around the town. The damage is considerable. The town has suffered a lot. The official history of the New Zealand Rifle Brigade says, unable to restrain their expressions of joy at deliverance, they, the townsfolk, repeatedly broke into the ranks, thrust flowers and cakes and flags upon our men, and freely embraced them in a manner peculiar and common to the French, but most embarrassing to the stolid New Zealanders. Major Lindsay Inglis was serving when he arrived at the town with the New Zealand Machine Gun Corps, and he said all along the street the diggers marched, embraced and kissed, showered with autumn flowers. The excited civilians stuck flowers in the men's tunics and even in their respirators and flowed cheering into the main square. One of the girls ran out of the room to return in a few minutes with a bottle of cognac and a bundle of rags from which she unrolled a small tin of fancy biscuits. In cups of cognac, we drank each other's healths. Rifleman James Nimmo with the 3rd Battalion of the New Zealand Rifle Brigade, perhaps he could see that the end of the war was drawing close, because he said that night the whole German garrison surrendered. I don't know how many there were, but I think it was about 2,000. Peace looks very close now. Another civilian said the town was an unforgettable sight. The houses were full of New Zealanders standing on the roofs, clapping noisily and continuously. And perhaps the final word should go to Company Sergeant Major Alec Trafford, also of the 3rd Battalion New Zealand Rifle Brigade. He simply said, sleep tonight will be wonderful. And as we draw this podcast to a close, let's go back to that ceremony that was held at the ramparts in 2018 and listen to the voices, those accents, those wonderful soft accents from New Zealand.
Chaplain David Julian, together with Lieutenant Colonel Mel Childs and her children, Hunter and Lily, will rededicate the New Zealand Memorial, which was first unveiled in 1923. The memorial is designed to give beautiful effect upon the ancient walls and give life to the figure of peace. Beneath her feet is a broken sword, and in her hand she holds a laurel wreath, all in hope for future peace. Today's rededication is a symbolic renewal of the call for future generations to remember the human sacrifice here and dedication to work for collective peace.
And then two young children threw some flowers into the moat as a symbol of peace that had just been mentioned. And finally, there was a short ceremony that I'm going to play here, and included was the playing by a New Zealand Armed Forces Band of The Last Post, which we always play at the end of our podcast. And this week we remember the 196 soldiers and all the other New Zealand soldiers that died during the Great War.
Kalabari, present arms. Thank you. Calvary, shoulder, arm.